Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Well, you've heard me say it before, and let me repeat it again. Energy is the master resource. No energy means no economy, period, end of discussion. I know, here in the waning days of 2015, with steadily falling gasoline prices, most people have taken their eye off the energy ball. Many are assuming that low prices mean we're awash in oil, that there are no supply issues we need to worry about, and further, that peak oil is a defunct concept. But what if none of those things are actually true? What if instead these low prices should concern you more than they calm you? What if we do live in a world with physical limits that couldn't care less about how clever humans are? For those of us who study this issue of energy broadly and oil more specifically, these low prices today are quite concerning and indicate that we should be paying even closer attention rather than letting our focus wander. Our guest today is the perfect person to discuss these issues. Gail Tverberg runs the blog OurFiniteWorld.com and has penned numerous articles about the intersection between energy and the economy. Gail is trained as an actuary and is a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society and a member of the American Academy of Actuaries. Gail has been actively researching and exploring the concepts and implications related to oil, peak oil, and economic growth for about a decade. Gail, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, listen, let's start here, Gail. Why is an actuary actually a very appropriate profession and person to be looking at the issues of energy and oil in the economy?
Well, basically, actuaries are the ones who model how things will play out in the future. Actuaries are especially known for their work with pension plans and forecasting, you know, how much money needs to be set aside in a pension plan so that there will be enough money with interest and with stock market rises and whatnot all, so that there will be enough money for each of these people who retire. And of course, they also figure out how much contributions need to be to Social Security. There are other types of insurance they're involved with as well, including medical malpractice, workers' compensation, and auto insurance, homeowners. And I came from that side of the tracks, but I still was enough involved that I was very much aware of how this all worked together, and I knew how critical it was that the assumptions regarding how high future rates of return would be to making the whole system work. So I could see very early on that if anybody was estimating based on what was happening in the past, they probably were biasing their estimates as of the amount of contributions to the fund as being way too low. They were assuming that they could fund the pensions much more easily than they really could, for example.
Well, certainly. So just economically, you know, funding a pension, there's a bunch of assumptions that feed into it. You have to make sure that you understand really the inflows and the outflows at a macro level, and there's a lot of variables that go into that. And of course, people who are just looking at this fully through the economic lens make a bunch of assumptions about how the economy works based on how it used to work. And where I think you and I come into this story in trying to educate people is around the idea that you can't just look at the economy alone. You have to understand the feedstock to the economy itself. And so energy starts to factor into this. Is that fair? And second, do you think anybody in the pension actuarial system or anybody else looking at the long range trajectories, who's really factoring in energy into their long term calculations of returns?
Well, I think your assessment's pretty much right about energy being very important in these long term assessments. In terms of who's actually factoring it in, I know when I started talking about high oil prices back a few years ago when the prices were high then the casualty actuaries who were busy working on autos and homeowners were extremely interested because they said, aha, we can raise our rates based on this, that, and the other thing. Or maybe with the auto, the high oil prices will get people to drive less, so maybe we can make more profit. So they were interested in that subject. But when it comes to something that looks like, oh, we've got a fundamental problem, I know one person got me a place to talk to a group of life actuaries one time, and I think this was a breakfast meeting that I was a speaker at, and I think they almost choked on their breakfast when I talked about it. They were not nearly so enthusiastic. And I did talk at the International Congress of Actuaries last year, too, or it was a little over a year ago. And the attendance was not nearly as good as it should be. Last year's problem, oil prices are down. Why do we care about this anymore? Go away, folks. I don't want to hear about this is sort of the issue. So there are a few actuaries on the fringe who found my work and have been following it. But, the companies that are, well, let's see, the consulting firms that are doing the work in it and the companies that are doing the work in it can't possibly face the problem that would occur if anyone admitted that there's a real downward trend in rates of return and that the thing, whole thing could blow up on them.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because how much time do we need before we say there's low rates of return? By my counting, we're well over a decade of global low rates of return. That, of course, comports very well with the story that people in the peak oil community have been, at least you and I have been talking about for a while, is that as your cost of energy goes up, your rates of larger economic return are going to moderate. And particularly when you look at the amount of debt and the rate of debt accumulation and the pace of it, you know, at $3, $4, $5, $6, $12 of debt required to create a new dollar of GDP. Isn't a decade long enough? Are people getting concerned in that field that maybe we are, as Jeremy Grantham says, in a new environment of persistently low rates of return?
Well, I think what's happening, you know, from my distant vantage point, is that there has been a trend. You know, the ones that were assuming, you know, on the pension plans, 10.5% annual rate of return indefinitely have brought it down, you know, but maybe you get it down to 8% or 7%, you know. And that's assuming some kind of a mix between stocks and bonds, you know, and if the bonds are yielding not very much, you have to assume the stock market is just going through the roof. So, it's just a crazy world, but it's sort of one of these things, well, we were up at this level before, so we'll kind of move it down by increments. And that's sort of the way I think the business world works. You know, if you've made an estimate one year and it's not quite right, you just kind of adjust it a little bit the next year and you keep hoping that you can adjust it down slowly and nobody, you know, says, well, we made a mistake. We'll just kind of adjust it. And next year maybe we'll be closer to right because there's, you know, regression towards the mean and the mean should be way up high like we're used to it.
Well, now let's talk about that mean being way up high. Of course, that was developed during a set of decades, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and the 1900s, that we had this very rapid, long-term persistent rate of economic growth, 3, 4% real rates of growth per year, sometimes higher, but a long-term average, very high. And compounding, of course. And that was in an era when we were actually growing our oil production at 1.5%, sometimes 2%, sometimes even higher, per year. And you've got a fantastic chart from a while ago, maybe well over a year ago now, that just shows the rate of oil extraction by period. And of course, it had a very high slope, 3-4%, and then it tipped over and was 2-3%. And it's been very flat, low growth for the past decade or so. To me, that seems like an obvious connection between rates of energy extraction and use and economic growth. Talk to us about energy and the economy for a minute. I mean, is that just a correlation, or is there a causation in that chart, do you think?
Yes. You know, the more we look at it, the more we see that the rate of growth of energy supply is very closely correlated with the rate of GDP growth. And I know on some of my recent posts, I've included a chart that goes back to 1820 that shows the same correlation, that you have to have an increasing supply of energy in order to get GDP growth. The GDP growth tends to be a little higher than the other. Than the energy growth, and that's especially the case when we made the change in the mid-70s, you know, when we had the big first oil crisis, and we realized that, you know, that, say, Japan had already started making small cars, and so we could make smaller cars, and we could save quite a bit of oil very quickly. And we realized then that we didn't have to burn oil to create electricity. There were a lot of other alternative approaches, including nuclear. So we pulled those offline, and there were home heating had been done by oil, and it was easy to transfer that to other types of energy. So we had a number of different things we could do very quickly back then, and I think people got the idea that, you know, because we could pick the low-hanging fruit then, somehow or other, we could do the same thing again, but we're not getting that same kind of effect anymore.
Well, let's talk about that, this effect, because I know after the Paris COP21 meetings about global climate change and the role of carbon in that, there was a lot of excitement in some sectors of the population saying, oh, look, we've finally made an agreement. We're going to get off of fossil fuels. We're just going to switch to solar or wind or something. But at any rate, we're going to go to these alternative energies. We're going to use those. We're going to replace oil. You're saying that so far that hasn't really happened to any really needle-moving sort of a way on the dial, but that that the low-hanging fruit is gone. Talk to us about that, because I'm really concerned that some people think that we're going to be able to just shift from a very highly concentrated, delicious, tasty energy source, which is oil, to alternative energies. What are the numbers really? How big of a challenge is that?
Well, I think the thing that people don't realize is how closely the growth in debt is tied to the growth in the economy. Mm-hmm. Even back many years ago, we needed to add more debt to try to, as the economy sort of attempted to grow. And what you would see very often back then was, you know, some country would add debt to fund a war, and if they were successful, maybe they would get some increment to their economy so that the debt made sense. And if they lost the war, then somebody got their bonds written off. But what's happened is that as the cost of energy has gone up, especially since about the mid-70s, the amount of debt required to fund GDP growth has gone way, way up. And I think this is because it takes so much more debt, or so much more, we need a given quantity of energy in terms of BTUs, or in terms of, you know, how far can make a truck go. And if it costs a whole lot more to do that, we're going to have to borrow a whole lot more money in order to make the whole system operate. So this we have seen a spiraling of debt since the mid-70s, and I think that's very much related to the higher cost of energy since then.
I'll go one step further. I totally agree with you, but you know, an observation of mine is that the compounded nominal rate of growth in debt since the 70s in the United States has been very close to 8% per annum. It's at 7.9%. And the real rate of economic growth under that is about half. The nominal rate is still less than that. So we've been growing our debts faster than the underlying economy. At the same time, there's been this persistent upward increase in the cost of energy, at least for oil, that, you know, it's very noisy data series, but it sort of took some step functions from $20 a barrel to 30 to 40, and then, of course, spiking well over 100 at a couple of points. It's back down again now at this point. Very, very noisy series, but the trend is obvious. It's been going up. So what's interesting is you said there's a connection that really just hit me, was that as the cost of energy goes up, we need to increase the amount of debt that we apply to the system. And against that backdrop, I want to put this observation I've had, which is that we've been compounding our debt at roughly twice the rate of the economic growth underneath it. So it feels to me there's multiple pieces we have to keep track of here, but that if I have them right, we want economic growth, which requires debt growth. Debt growth has been happening faster than underlying economic growth itself. Economic growth, of course, is tied to energy. As energy costs go up, what that really means is that if we want all that to keep working as it has been, we're going to have to really dial up the rate of debt growth. Is that about right?
Yes. And that only works for a while. You know, you can dial up your debt growth for a while, but then you discover that debt growth has a lot of adverse effects. And one of the big ones is that it tends to funnel money to the wealthier class and take money away from the poor members of society. So I think I was just reading an article this morning where they were talking about these microloans in Africa and other such places. They've discovered that what happens is this money just funnels money to the wealthy classes. It doesn't really do anything for the economy as a whole. It just creates sort of a mess. But we have that happening everywhere, that as you add more debt, the interest tends to go to the banks, to the insurance companies, and it pulls it out of the economy. It tends to make the people, it gives businesses relatively less funds to pay out in wages, and it tends to reduce the amount of money that the average, I guess we'll call it non-elite worker has to pay for goods. So it works in the wrong direction in terms of supporting future ability to buy energy products.
So this is an interesting paradox then, because what you're describing if we were going to form a hypothesis, we would say in a debt-based money system, as you need to increase the rate, the amount of debt creation, the only way to really sustain that over any set of time, say decades, is you're going to have to lower the rate of interest. Because as more and more debt is out in the system, the only way to continue to foster more creation of more debt, if that's what the system depends on, is to lower the rate of interest. Because obviously a higher rate of interest bankrupts your primary clients, that being the citizens and the governments that are needing to do all that borrowing for you. So isn't that interesting that ever since energy has been steadily becoming more expensive since the late 70s, early 80s, we've seen our interest rate, again, a noisy data series, go from 14% on the short end to zero and to even into negative territory. Are you suggesting all this is like could we start to form a hypothesis and say these all might be connected?
Yes, I would definitely say they're connected. I think that that's the only way that the economies could keep growing. And I think, you know, the quantitative easing that was done last year, or not just last year, since 2008, it was what helped get the oil prices back up again. And it was what helped keep the whole economy from collapsing way back then. If it hadn't been for that, you know, we would not have been able to get interest rates even lower and kept the whole system together a bit longer.
So the system, though, ultimately was reliant on cheap energy. And it seems like the people who are in charge of maintaining the status quo, from my perspective, the Janet Yellens, formerly Ben Bernanke, Jean-Claude Juncker, whoever's Trichet, all these people in Europe, Kuroda in Japan, that all of them are actually fully steeped in the economic side of this. They fully understand the importance and the role of debt growth and all of that. They're pumping as hard as they can to keep all of that debt growth in there. growing. They've been pretty successful. Nearly $60 trillion of new debt since the 2007 crisis. That, you know, golf clap, they did a great job cramming more debt into the system. But what you're saying is that until and unless cheap energy persistently comes back to the landscape, they are destined to fail.
Exactly. Exactly. And you end up with more and more disparities. You know, what happens is that the prices don't stay up with the cost of production. We hear so often about oil prices being low, but it's not just oil prices. That's just one little piece out of this total problem we have. It's natural gas prices, it's coal prices, I believe it's uranium prices, it's metal prices of all kinds, you know, iron ore or steel as it's made, aluminum, copper, quite a few of the other metals. Some of the food prices, too, are very low. So what we end up with is many, many, many parts of society where prices are falling way too low.
Now, these low prices, let's talk about that, because, of course, we get a lot of our signals as individuals, as investors, from market prices. Market prices clearly, in all of those areas you mentioned and a few others beside, but across the commodity complex, measured in total, the commodity complex hasn't been at this level, this price level, since the late 90s. Of course, the cost to produce these things has skyrocketed since then. The cost of farmland per acre, the cost of mining equipment, you name it. It's just the cost structure has gone up extraordinarily. So we are seeing now many, many different commodities that are currently priced below their marginal cost of production. For those listening, that means the cost to produce the next barrel of oil, the next ton of iron ore, the next ton of coal, whatever that is, the marginal cost of production is now higher. And so for oil is easy. This is an easy one. To get a barrel of oil out of the ground, all-in cost is probably averaging across the globe. It varies tremendously. It's probably $80. Could be 120 in some ultra deep water. Might be as low as 40, 50 in certain sweet spots in the Eagle Ford. So what does it mean, Gail, what is that telling us, that these commodities are now priced below their marginal cost of production?
Well, I'm afraid what it means is that at some point there's got to be a discontinuity. Something's got to break. And I think, you know, we talk about the marginal cost of production, but it's the whole economy that has to hang together. It's not just we have to get it out of the ground, but it's that, say, Saudi Arabia has to get enough taxes, the prices have to be high enough that Saudi Arabia gets taxes so it can provide services to its people. And many other countries are depending on the oil for their taxes. So when you say that you can get it out of the ground for $80 or whatever, that misses the point that it doesn't really cover all of the costs of keeping the economy together. We really probably need $120, $150, or even more dollars per barrel so that, say, Russia would have enough for its tax structure, and Iraq and Iran and Venezuela all would have enough for their tax structure. And even the U.S., certainly Brazil, could use a whole lot more money for its tax structure from the oil.
Well, and I'll go further and say the United States, you mentioned it briefly, but the same dynamic. People go, oh, yeah, look at the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They need $120 oil because they take so much of this money and funnel it to their society. The United States, we funnel a lot of our costs. We foist them off on the taxpayer and pretend they don't exist. So I'll talk about Texas. Texas collects severance taxes from the oil industry, and that's great because the oil industry uses things like public roads, bridges, other infrastructure, water, you name it. And in 2014 is the last year I have data for, Texas collected, I think, $1.3 billion in severance taxes and incurred $4 billion in road damage alone. So it's clear that that industry is being subsidized. So when I say you can get oil out of the ground profitably for, say, $40, $50 a barrel in the Eagle Ford, which is in Texas, what I'm really saying is companies can operate profitably, but the whole system can't. So thank you for widening that out, because you're absolutely right. We have to look at what does the total system require? Forget about the fact that Continental Resources makes money at $50 a barrel in the Eagle Ford. our society is steadily getting poorer in total when they're selling it for $50 a barrel, because they're probably incurring $20 a barrel in road damage and other social ills. And then ultimately somebody has to cap those wells, yada, yada. There's a whole associated sea of things that have to happen for the total cost of that oil to really be fully met. So what you're saying is that at these low prices, we're actually incurring not just the damage to Continental Resources balance sheet and income statements, but something far wider is happening.
Well, that and just the fact that you have to keep the whole economy going and growing. You know, in Saudi Arabia, it may not be that they're damaging the roads that much. It's just the fact that if you don't want the government overthrown, you have to have some kind of programs that will keep people occupied. You know, they need some sort of way. There's a very high unemployment rate as it is. They need to have some kind of programs to keep these people busy and housed and food available to them. And so they have to have some kind of a very high tax structure from it. But all of the countries depend very much on the taxes. I mean, Russia does too. Venezuela does. All of the oil exporters and pretty much all of the oil producers. You go to Alaska, they have not had an income tax for many years. In fact, I think every citizen gets a rebate check based on the taxes that the oil companies pay. So this is very common that the taxes from oil are a big piece of what makes the whole economy work.
And so you said earlier something has to break with these low oil prices, and in Saudi Arabia it might be social rest. They might break into social unrest, and in Alaska people are going to have to get used to the flow of money going the other direction out of their pockets on a yearly basis. But I want to talk about that something has to break maybe being the price of oil in the future. I'd love to get your point of view on something I've been tracking and wondering about, which is the loss of CapEx investment over the past year or year and a half or so. I believe that oil companies, the big ones, the international oil companies, it was in February 2014, even before the price started to decline in June of 2014, they started to pull or freeze their CapEx budgets backwards because they weren't able to profitably both invest in new oil production and pay dividends at the same time. So they were trimming CapEx to push more money back to dividend payments and things like that. Now that we have, I think, about $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion of failed CapEx investments over the last year, year and a half, what do you think happens to future oil supplies?
Well, I think that we're going to see a shifting, at least, of future oil supplies. I think one of the issues is that all of this CapEx is not going to result in oil production. At the same time, we've got all of the zero interest money that was put into Iraq that's going to raise their production, and we've got Iran sitting there talking about raising its production. So it's not obvious that at a particular point in time which direction it goes. You know, we've got one group that's coming off and another group that wants to come online. But the direction certainly has to be towards going down. Or something just breaking within the system just because there's so many defaults on loans and that bringing the system down and we can't afford to pay for it. I think the other thing I would point out is that we're reaching points where it's not clear that we can even store anymore oil or refined products, crude oil and refined products. It doesn't look like it's too far away, but that's going to be a crisis, and that by itself is going to send the price way, way, way down.
Right. So I agree with you. I'm looking for additional price weakness in the future, largely because the demand side of the equation is not all that strong. And I'm looking at China, of course, as the big dog in this particular story, whose economy appears to be fraying at the seams. So price is a function of supply and demand for oil in particular, because it's so inelastic in terms of its storage. Once you run out of storage space, there's really not a lot that's going to happen, I think, beyond some price destruction. And that price destruction, though, leads to future supply disruption. So if the world wants to get back to high rates of growth again, and so let's imagine there is some crisis, some economic crisis, a big deflationary wave that's really spawned by a variety of intersecting factors, and even after the fact, we might not know what it was. Was it debt defaults in the oil companies themselves? Was it social unrest in some kingdom somewhere that spilled over? Who knows? But what you're saying is that these low oil prices are going to create their own forms of damage. It's a self-feeding loop for a while, fed in part by this mountain of debt. Let's imagine all of that sort of works itself out of the system. I agree it's going to happen at some point. But then the world wants to pick itself up off the mat and go forward again, and it's going to suddenly start to go through a cycle of growth. Where do you think oil supplies will be at that moment? That could be 3-4 years from now.
Well, I don't think we're going to have them there. I think we're going to end up with a discontinuity in the whole economy. It's going to be, we can't get the debt to keep growing high enough to keep the prices up to get to the level. And, of course, it takes a long lead time to put any new capital expenditures in. So the fact that they haven't been making the investments now says, you know, you can't make up for lost time. You've even lost some of the people you had working on it. So it's going to be very hard to do anything going forward to try to make up for what you lost.
So the feedback loop that you're talking about, because this one worries me a lot, $200 trillion of debt. As we spiral into low economic growth because we're having these debt deflations, and then all of a sudden the oil price goes low, and no rational oil company in the world would look at $20, $30 a barrel oil and say, I'm going to invest in $120 a barrel oil, in the ultra deep water off the coast of Brazil. And so the longer those companies wait, the less oil comes out of the ground. The less oil comes out of the ground, the less economic growth we have. The less economic growth we have, the more debt defaults we have. The more of those we have, it just you're talking about a spiral that seems very hard to get out of once it gets started.
Well, and I think the derivatives come along a lot earlier than that, too. Ooh. And once the derivatives start defaulting, and I don't have a good intuitive feel for exactly what happens and what goes wrong, but I think that could start some problems very much earlier than the other things.
So what you're really talking about is several decades of mismanagement and bad ideas, bad assumptions. So we have some really bad assumptions out there that have led to the accumulation of several hundred trillion dollars of debt, which by the way, the only way you can do that, and I'm not even talking unfunded liabilities, which number in the 5 to 10 times higher than that, depending on the country we're talking about in terms of their actual debt loads. But what you're talking about is several hundred trillion of debt that got built up with the assumption that there would always be the future growth necessary to service that, so we could grow our debt at much faster than underlying economic growth because we were certain about something that turned out not to be true.
Right. And I think part of what confused us in all of this was the fact that there was inflation along with the economic growth. Mm-hmm. And I think this confused actuaries too. They said, oh, the rate of return on these bonds or whatever, we're getting 8%. You know, well, they didn't stop to think that some of that was compensation for the inflation rate. So, going back there, they thought they could continue to grow their debt along with the inflation rate. And keep raising it. Now, when you suddenly go to negative, deflation, then you have a problem because you can no longer pay back the debt that's outstanding. And of course, the value of the assets start falling as you have a problem. You know, if the price of oil and coal and all of these other things is very low, these companies are not going to be able to pay back their loans, and the asset prices that are associated, even the farmland prices, are going to go down.
Well, this is, you have your finger on a huge problem, which is that, of course, inflation, which every central bank is actually targeting right now, inflation erodes the future value of your obligations, and deflation does the opposite. It actually increases the present value of your future obligations because it means that you're going to have to be paying back in money that's actually worth more, not less, in the future. And who has experience? Like, do we even have the knowledge to know how to write the formulas to account for that properly at this point in time, let alone the institutional knowledge to know how to manage that sort of territory?
Yeah, it becomes a question. You know, when we were the opposite direction, what we were doing is we were taking all of the, not all of it, but at least part of the excess money was getting funneled to insurance companies, pension plans, banks, you know, whatever, all to the elite in the society. But now as you go down, you can't just pull money back out of pension plans and pull it away from whoever, the insurance companies or whoever might have it. I think the elite have discovered the same offshore tax havens that the businesses have. So you're kind of stuck there, that this money that goes to these people is just sort of gone. How do you deal with a negative interest rate? Who do you get it from?
It's more of a sociological than even a financial question. It's a whole new way of thinking. I don't even know that economics is the right branch of study. I'm not going to use the word science. I don't even know if it's the right branch of study to answer that question. I might have to go to behavioral economics or some other place. So obviously this is about how the pieces fit together. So one of the things we've been seeing is a fairly stubbornly low wage growth. You talked about the importance of inflation in the 70s and how that formed our thinking and all of that. But a lot of that inflation in the 70s was driven by a wage and price spiral. We may well get the price spiral in the future, but wages are pretty stubborn. How do you explain low wages in this larger story that we've been talking about?
Well, I think there are several things that are involved with the low wages. The wages are a way of distributing what value you're getting from the economy. And if the economy is really growing more slowly, you have less to distribute. So that's part of the problem. Part of what happens is that through all of these interest payments and such things, dividend payments, and also growing government programs, we end up funneling more and more of the money away from the wage earner. And also, as it becomes harder and harder to get oil out and to do all of these things, you no longer have just little mom-and-pa businesses that can do the work and that don't need to depend on, you know, very much management. They can just pay their own wages. You start getting the need for bigger, more elaborate, even international businesses. And as they do this, they add more and more to kind of an overhead expense. And they have these big fancy buildings, and they jet from country to country. But the poor little wage earner doesn't get very much out of the whole system. So it's these wage earners that can no longer buy new houses and new cars, and that tends to hold down the prices because, you know, if you're not building more houses and you're not building more cars, there's less demand for commodities.
I think if we, you know, one of the ways I like to look at this, and it's, I know it's overly simplistic, but it helps me, is to think about net energy per capita. And it's pretty easy to see that, at least in terms of the United States, oil production and also consumption per capita, but looking at net energy, net oil production per capita, it actually peaked out in the mid-70s and has been steadily going down ever since, and wages have been stubbornly not moving very far either. I see those as connected, and so the larger thing I see, let me just make it really simple. Once the energy companies are consuming 100% of the capital and are actually almost 100% of the economy, because that's how expensive it is to get energy out of the ground, we will have this really tiny, shriveled, shrunken economy around it, and nobody will be, you know, the number of jobs available, the number of the amount of wages that will be paid will be a tiny fraction of what it is today. So in some respects, Gail, this is the most important issue we need to look at, which is how are we producing energy as a nation What are our long-term plans around how we're going to do that? And how are we going to manage this idea that the type of growth and energy and assumptions we had in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, even 90s, those are irretrievably changed into some new landscape? To me, that seems like the conversation we should be having, and we're not.
Yeah, right. And we don't stop to realize that, you know, adding a gazillion new wind turbines and solar panels is not a very efficient way of doing things. You know, we have been had the luxury of having a very efficient method of getting energy, and it's gone away, and now we're choosing a different, very inefficient method of doing it.
Well, let's talk about that. Why is that inefficient?
Well, what did they say? There were 100 solar panel installers for every coal miner in the U.S., even though we have 100 times as much coal used for energy as we do for wind turbines. I guess it's for solar panels.
Yep.
I'm getting confused here.
Yep.
You end up with an awfully lot of workers, and they're doing something, and somebody is saying this should have some effect off in the future. But the way calculations are done when they are saying, well, how much energy is used in doing this, they say, well, those workers, well, we should count the oil in their car as they drive to install these. But the fact that we pay them high salaries, or low salaries probably, and they use that those wages for other things like going to the grocery store and such, we don't consider that because that's not part of the cost of actually extracting it. So it's not clear that we have a real good way of measuring it. And what the way our economy works, it works on what we have in a particular year. And the fact that we envision that these solar panels or wind turbines should be operating 10 or 20 years from now is nice, but that's not the way the economy works. It works on what actually is the amount of electricity we're actually producing this year, as opposed to something that's in a model somewhere.
Well, that's interesting. As I put all this together, I feel like my country, the United States, has no real strategic plan for how we're going to manage our energy transitions. And the amount of unfortunate misinformation that exists around the whole shale oil story is astonishing to me, because even the EIA can look at any particular shale basin and tell you how much is in there, when will, you know, at current rates, when we'll hit a peak of production, and when that will irretrievably tail off. And that peak, Gail, is not far out. You know, it's as low as, it's as soon as, used to be as soon as 2020 for shale oil. It probably got bumped out a few years because of the price hiccups that we're in right now. But it doesn't matter. It peaks at some point and not that far out in the future. And so we should be saying how much resource is there, how many BTUs or how much work is in that resource. What would we like to do with that amount of work? And right now, the answer is business as usual. We want to sell more cars. We want to build more houses, you know, none of which really conform to what I consider to be useful energy guidelines for efficiency and things like that. And so as I talk to my listenership and viewership, is I say that the way of the future, clearly there is still some low-hanging fruit out there, but it's in efficiency. It's in doing more with less. It's in building smaller houses. It's in things we already know. It doesn't exist in brand new technologies being developed and installed at mass scale. It's really about how can we run our lives effectively with half the energy or less. It seems like there is some low-hanging fruit there. Would you agree with that?
Perhaps. I think the big issue is that as you try to get this low-hanging fruit, you tend to lose jobs. And as you tend to lose jobs, it makes it harder to keep the financial system going.
Going.
You know, so while you save something, it doesn't really save anything. And when you stop and figure it out, you say, oh, we can build smaller houses. Well, actually, when you look at it, we could all just group together in the houses we have. You know, what's the point? Do we really need to be building a whole bunch more houses? Maybe they need to be in different places, but the different places probably aren't the places that the planners would put them. They probably put them in the middle of New York City or something. So, you know, it's not as easy a problem as it sometimes looks like, especially when you think about this wage problem.
Well, yeah, I agree with that, but you put your finger on something I'd love to get your view on, which is you mentioned what the financial system requires. So the financial system clearly requires, well, at least from my observation, as somebody who's seen three cycles of this, well, two, coming on a third cycle, it seems to either be growing or collapsing. It doesn't seem to have a great, awesome middle-of-the-road territory place, at least when it comes to debt growth. How do you see this playing out in the financial system over time?
Well, I'm afraid that we're going to hit a discontinuity, and it's hard to tell exactly how far away it is. But the banks are the ones, well, and insurance companies and the pension plans are the ones where there's going to be a big problem. And, of course, the bond market, too. But what happens is we're going to start seeing a lot of debt defaults, and we may have some derivative problems at the same time as we get these debt defaults. And then the problem is, how does this flow through the system? Back in 2008, the governments bailed out the banks. Well, this year, they've tried to figure out how they can avoid bailing out the banks. And I was just reading now, too, that they've come up with a scheme where they're trying to move the mortgage, if the mortgage is default, like they did back in the 2006, 7, 8, 9, 2010 period. If they start defaulting again, what they're trying to move that away from government support and to the supposed individual investors. But when I look at it, they're moving that to derivatives. So what happens is that you have more and more out in derivatives. When I read what Ellen Brown says, she says that derivatives have first priority, or they're considered, those assets come before the bank account that individual investors have.
Yeah, they're senior.
So they're senior to it. So what happens is, if you have a big derivative problem, is that it may end up getting pushed over to individual investors getting haircuts on their loans. So it could be individual folks like us, or it could be employers who need their funds to make their payroll payments. Regardless of which it is, if we can't use our bank accounts to buy things, or if employers can't use their bank accounts to pay their employees, we've got a problem either way.
So you say discontinuity. Thank you for the euphemism. It's, to me, that means anything from a complete failure of the financial system to banking holidays to capital controls to increasingly chaotic, extremely volatile market conditions. You're worried about derivatives. I am too. I think that, my simple statement that I put out, when you have this much debt on the books and our growth prospects are obviously this hampered, and that discontinuity, that gap between reality and fiction grows, I think that there's only one question we have to answer at this point, and that is this: who's going to eat the losses? And obviously the banks are very interested in rewriting the rules to make sure that the derivatives get paid off, because, of course, a derivative is just a bet. It has an equal set of winners and losers. It's not this magic thing that can create losses that wouldn't otherwise exist. It's a bet, and the banks want to make sure that their bets with each other get paid off at the expense of somebody, which in this case would be the depositors in the bank. Why people aren't more freaked out about that, I don't know. When you say there's some sort of discontinuity, that, to me, I translate that, you're saying that there's really no fix to this at this point in time. We really just have to figure out how we're going to unwind a whole bunch of bad bets that have already been made, placed, and run their course.
Yes. I mean, what happens is, you know, we've heard about Ponzi schemes when there's individual investments, you know, where somebody comes in and says, oh, invest in this. It's growing and growing and growing. And, you know, if you just contribute to my plan, you'll get your money back plus, you know, 40% or something. And, in fact, they're making 2% on it. But what they do is they attract enough new investors that they can keep this whole scheme going for a while, and they get more and more money in, and they make their money by the funds they skim off the top. Well, what happens is that all of this debt growth looks more and more like a Ponzi scheme, because we've had this growth and we've had more and more and more of this growth, but at some point you get to a point where you can't get enough additional debt to keep the whole thing going. And it looks like something that could fall over from its own weight.
Well, that's exactly the dynamic that happened with the housing bubble in the United States. I think that's about to visit a number of other housing localities. Australia, are you listening? Canada, hello. Number of places, London. But what you're describing is a basic dynamic which humans are prone to. We named it after Charles Ponzi, but those schemes have been going on a long time. What you're describing, though, is the big Ponzi scheme, which is the Ponzi scheme of debt as a concept as it's been used and expressed currently. So you're talking potentially something even larger, a sovereign debt crisis or a truly massive corporate debt crisis or even just a crisis in the belief in debt itself as it's currently practiced, something larger, very systemic. Is that right?
Right. What happened is that as long as we had economic growth, which we seem to be able to sustain, you know, it started right after World War II when we used a whole lot of debt to try to get the whole world economy going quickly and such, and then it continued after that. But as we had all of this rapid growth, we got this belief that, of course, this rapid growth would continue in the future. So as we did that, we made whole changes in the system. So we believed that we could have pension plans and we could have insurance companies and we could have all of these other things that would depend on this whole system continuing according to the way we had seen things in this fairly short period. But of course, you can't really assume that that's going to go on forever. It was sort of a temporary phenomenon, but at that time, we put in place a retirement program. Well, I guess we started that way back in, what, 32 or something. But as you went forward, we put in more and more different programs, assuming we could really financialize this debt, we could make use of it, and we could build layers and layers upon it. That, you know, instead of debt, you know, if you have a bond, you'd say, oh, this is an asset of mine because now I can depend on getting the repayment of it, and I can depend on the interest. And so once you had that, you could build a whole system around it, and you could make pile upon pile of, oh, this is how the system will work in the future. I think if you go back, you know, 200 years or 100 years, you'll find that it was much more the governments that granted loans to the individuals, or, you know, they were the ones who took out debt, and they were for wars, but they also might give loans, say, to farmers or something of that sort. So you have a very different kind of a system forming, and that system is quite vulnerable to collapses.
Well, of course, debt isn't anything real. It's an agreement. It's like wages. It's a means of laying claim to and then distributing the actual real productive output of an economy. The real productive output, of course, is real goods, real services, real things. There are claims that we lay on top of that. So what you're describing is that this whole idea of retirement was really a way of distributing the excess surplus that could come out of an economy, itself a function of growth, that itself a function of energy at the root of all of that. So if I could translate this and skinny it down, what you might be saying is that retirement itself as a concept, may be a 2 to 3 generation long artifact of the fossil fuel bonanza we tapped into.
Well, we were talking about it a little bit earlier before we started this phone call, and I got to thinking about it a little further. When the retirement plans were put in place was during the Depression. And the reason they were put into place, the Social Security and such things, was to get rid of some of the excess workers, to take them off the street. And so this was, you know, they didn't have very many that they put into the plan at that point in time. But that at that point, they had a problem similar to what we have today of, you know, low wages, low prices, and they were trying to fix that kind of problem. So I would agree that they it very much depends on the surplus energy of the society, but it's tied in different ways than you would necessarily expect. It promises things that may very well not be there. Unless you have the system growing rapidly, you can't make it actually work.
Right, and lots and lots and lots of factors, robotization, global workforce, lots of factors sort of playing in on all this. But I think if I could summarize this as we get to the end here, is that the assumptions we've held in the past may not necessarily be the right ones. In fact, we'll go further and say that the assumptions of the past are the wrong ones to be relying on and depending on, that perhaps there are some things we can carry from the past, but we need some new thinking. We need some new ways of looking at this. We need to cast aside our assumption about how the world works and how finance works and how growth works and all of that, because we're really at the tail end of a 4-decade-long experiment of trying a unbacked fiat currency system across an increasingly integrated global banking system that was more than happy to shake hands, look the other way, and allow debts to accumulate, pile up. Well, now they're all piled up. And you and I are having the conversation that says, well, now what? And the answer is neither of us can really see a way out of this now what besides reconciling with the idea that that wasn't a really good idea, maybe, or something like that.
Yeah, well, I guess one thing I'm struck by is how important debt is, though. The debt, think of you being a worker in a company. They aren't going to pay you day by day. The government or that employer has a debt to you that they will pay your wages. The debt is very much part of this whole system. You know, if you don't have debt, you can't get oil out of the ground. Well, especially at, you know, today's high cost level. If you just took a little shovel and you could get it out, that would be one thing. Or if you could pick up sticks off the ground and you can burn them, you know, that doesn't require much debt. But once you have a system where you have many different people involved and they have to do work in advance of actually getting the production out there, they either have to have debt or they have to have some kind of an equity-based arrangement, you know, where they're going to get dividends and they're going to share in the profits. But the two are pretty close to equivalent when it comes out to how this works in terms of transferring funds to the wealthier class of society. So this debt isn't something you can just sort of walk away from if you're going to have the big businesses that we have today. You know, if you just have little family arrangements, you can have kind of agreements that, you know, I'll build your house if you'll build my house, and there's no real debt involved. But once you start having big businesses building the houses and such things, you have to have some sort of a debt arrangement, or people just cannot afford to have the houses built.
So we've built a giant, very complex functioning economy with lots and lots of moving pieces. It's global now. To get oil out of the ground doesn't just require a drilling rig with a few guys on it. It requires dozens, if not hundreds, of associated companies producing all of the high technology pieces that are involved, even just in creating a single downbore tool that measures and drills or does whatever happens down there. So to function for our economy to function requires this extraordinarily complex machine to continue running. Our entire method of financing, which includes debt, especially, is integral to the functioning of that machine. And so you can't just take debt away, because what you do is you ruin the machine. And boy, we don't have any answer for that. So what you're describing is a machine that requires increasing complexity, increasing energy to function. Hey, what do we know about complex machines and systems? Well, they're inherently unpredictable in many ways.
Right.
And they do require constant inputs to maintain that complexity, inputs of energy in particular.
Right.
Fascinating. Well, we've been talking with Gail Verberg, and she runs the blog, the site, ourfiniteworld.com. Excellent articles there. Everybody listening, you really, really owe it to yourself to read and read carefully what Gail puts together there, because it's some of the best thinking and it's essential thinking. And by the way, it's not very common thinking yet, but it really should be. Because it's just such common sense when you sit down and put it together. So, Gail, is there anything else that we can let people know about your work and how to follow it?
I think you've covered it pretty well. You kind of have to go back through some of my old articles. I unfortunately don't have a book put together.
Well, maybe that'll come someday, but I absolutely agree that people should dig through the articles and start reading them, because you do make a very compelling case. So, with that, I want to thank you for your time today, and we'll do this again, because this story obviously is just beginning to unfold, and it's one of the most important stories out there. So thank you for your work.
Well, thank you.